The following is a message of the teaching ministry of Valley Bible Church in Billings, Montana. For more information, please visit our website at vbcmt.org.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for hanging with me. I realize people have to come and go, and thanks for being here. So we're going to look at session three, which is God's vertically focused commandments, the first four commandments. Again, all of these things, at times I provided too much information, and there's always more to say, and I'm trying to be judicious, and so thanks for being patient if I have to put my foot in the accelerator, and other times not. But I'm going to go ahead and open in prayer. Thanks so much, Lord, for a great meal and chance to fellowship with your people, the brethren here, and the joy of being with them. I do pray that you'd make this time profitable, and thank you for how we get a clear glimpse of some core values you had in mind for Israel that have a lot of carryover to us. Make our time profitable for your glory, be our strength, and I pray your spirit would help us to be and do more than we could be and do on our own. In Jesus' name, amen. So the Ten Commandments, in my mind, present the core values of Yahweh's expectations for his covenant people. And so they, and by the way, I would say the rest of the Mosaic Law, the 315 or whatever of those were, like an exposition of a concrete development of the Ten Commandments. I wouldn't make a one-for-one correspondence, but they're fleshing out his expectations in a very lofty way stated in the Ten Commandments. And then we only have time to go through the first four, but I think it's all of them I value. They're all part of God's value system. But the first four, I just thought if I had to pick some, those are the ones I'd pick. So first of all, in the outline, in the notes, I have kind of a brief introduction to the Ten Commandments, and I'm going to not labor as long as I might have thought I would have to make sure we can finish. I'm going to change my phone setting to not go to sleep as quickly as it is. Sorry. Yeah, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow again in Sunday school, but they are most directly addressing these first four, Israel's relationship with the Lord, in a very, very concrete way. But there are also several aspects of these commandments that are reemphasized in the New Testament as well. And we'll talk about some of those issues today and some maybe tomorrow morning. So part one, introduction to the Ten Commandments. Basic overview of the first five chapters of Deuteronomy. Verses 1 to 5, you have in Deuteronomy a preamble that kind of introduces Moses and what his primary agenda is in giving these laws. And then you have chapters 1 to 4, or like a historical front porch, a historical retrospect. 1 to 3 is more history, then 4 is preaching based on that history. So it's kind of like a front porch to the book. And then you have chapters 5 all the way to chapter 26 are specific stipulations and general stipulations. The general stipulations, chapter 5 to 11, which include two of the passages we're going to look at. We looked at chapter 4, we'll look at chapter 6 after this, could be summed up as a call to covenant loyalty, a call to allegiance, a call to heartfelt living. And then in 12 to 26 or more, what you think of when you think about law. It's going to be we'll talk about it, but the kind of the if-then law, the legal statements that are brief and succinct. That's coming. And then we'll be looking at some stuff after that tomorrow night. So this is in the general stipulation section, chapters 5 to 11, and God is calling his people to a life of loyalty. I'm not going to develop some stuff here for the sake of time, but look at, I think it's page 2. Do you have a chart called a comparison of casuistic and apodictic law? Are you there? You see it? Okay. Those are schnazzy words. It just is, it's like case law and Ten Commandment law, kind of. It's another way of saying it, but casuistic law, case law, is what in the book of Exodus and Leviticus is a bunch of that. It's if then. If in this situation, then this. So you have a circumstance, a precedent, if you will, and then the legislation itself. In Exodus 20:21, I think it is, when there are two guys fighting and somebody's wife is standing nearby and she tries to intervene and she's struck and her fruit departs and there is harm, there isn't harm. The if is the two guys fighting and she intervenes and then she's struck. And then the then is, what do we do? If there is harm, if there isn't harm. So you have to always keep in mind with the laws, the case law, which we're not looking at here, that the first part isn't the law. The first part is the issue being addressed. It isn't being high-fived. It isn't, you know, it just is part of life. And so the conduct in that circumstance is what's being addressed. So notice on the left side, the casuistic or case law begins with if or when. Usually in the third person, governed by a specific situation, often contains long explanatory comments, writers, qualifications. Here's an example of one, Genesis 15. If there's a poor man among your brothers in any of the towns of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, that's the circumstance. And they're going to have that happen. You know, they're going to be people whose the floor is caved in, the roof is collapsed, life has fallen apart. So you're an Israelite, and should be caring for fellow Israelites. And so here's the character of God coming through. Do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward your poor brother. Rather be open-handed and freely lend him whatever he needs. Okay, that's in the law as part of the Israelite covenant on the land of promise. But that the law itself, the legislation, is the second half of this law. There's more to say there, and we can talk more about that maybe tomorrow. Apodictic law, this is the Ten Commandment kind of version. They also are in Leviticus 26, Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5. It begins with the command, you shall, or you shall not, you must not. Very, very direct. Second person, you, statements of basic principle. General commands, usually without qualification, just pull no punches, just clear statement, like Exodus 23, you shall have no other gods before me, or Deuteronomy 5 as well. So just so you know that in the law, Deuteronomy has both kinds. 12 to 26 is mainly the case law. Ten Commandments are the apodictic law. And then just another kind of introductory thing. I thought Jim Hamilton has a helpful summary of the basic significance of each of the Ten Commandments. He appropriately emphasizes the centrality of Yahweh in each of these divine requirements that sometimes we don't get if we just don't think about it carefully. He writes, Yahweh is the most important thing about the Ten Commandments. When he gives voice to the inauguration of this covenant, the first thing he does is announce his own identity. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery, which we'll talk about in a minute. And then notice the command, no gods before him, no carved images of him, no misuse of his name, no work on the day he hallowed and blessed the Sabbath. The first four commandments obviously pertain to Yahweh, but perhaps the centrality of Yahweh to the last six commandments is less apparent on the surface, even though it is important anyway. These commands come with Yahweh's authority. They reflect the way that he has created the world. They're to be obeyed because he has spoken them, because he created this world by his word, because this world is made to work according to his word. Now, what I'm going to say here, and I'll emphasize it more tomorrow, is that they do come with divine authority, but they're part of the Mosaic law. And the Mosaic Law is not law for us today. So when I say I'm not keeping the Ten Commandments, I'm not saying I'm disobeying every one of them. Right? And what I'm saying is I'm not going to the Ten Commandments as law to motivate my obedience. I would go to the Ten Commandments for an understanding of God's value system that are re-enunciated in the New Testament, because there are a couple of things here that aren't going to come across. Did you see the difference or not? So I'm not trying to rock anybody's world, have you walk up to them, I hate the Ten Commandments or whatever. I'm not saying that. I'm not living by the Ten Commandments. I'm not trying to say I'm free from the low, happy condition. I'm saying it isn't law for me, but there's something to be learned from it that's beneficial. All right, so notice what Hamilton does, and this is what's helpful to try to keep the Yahweh background foundation in mind for the last of the commands. Fathers and mothers are to be honored because God is a father of his people and God is to be honored. No murder because God alone gives life and people are in God's image. No adultery because God made man male and female that the two might become one flesh. No theft because God makes poor and rich. No false witness because God does not lie. No coveting, because God alone is to satisfy, and at his right hand are pleasures forevermore. The authority and majesty and identity of Yahweh are central to all 10 of the commandments, and moral action is inseparably bound up with the worship of God. So we don't just have a legal focus with the 10 commandments. We're trying to remember who God is as the one who's giving us his value system that should motivate these truths. Because the thing like no coveting because God alone is to satisfy, people who covet aren't satisfied with what God's provided for them. And so as to set aside a worldly set of standards that can motivate coveting and say, God, thank you for taking care of me. Help me to trust you. Provide for my needs in a way that would glorify your name. I regularly pray for my students, Lord. I pray that you'd provide for this student in a way that reminds him of your greatness. And it may be a smidgen, right? It may not be massive, but at the right time. And it just is great to trust God. Because sometimes, and we all have known this in various degrees, we're hanging on by our fingernails. And we can only turn to God. And there are some things we have to do about living simply and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, those are values that I think are helpful. Part two, and this is looking at the first four of the Ten Commandments, just try to give a quick background. More could be said. Look at verse 6. I call this the relational front porch. Before the Ten Commandments, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the place of slavery. Yeah, the divine elector who chose them, and the divine deliverer who brought them out of Egypt, out of the place of slavery. I am the Lord your God. I am your God. You are my people. And I say here, on these two counts, Israel owes their existence to Yahweh. This verse anchors the Ten Commandments firmly in the immediately preceding history of Israel. Having come out of a polytheistic nation that worshipped the Pharaoh as a godlike person, Israel needs to maintain a focus on the one and only true God. Israel's history represents Yahweh as the ultimate and only God, not just over Israel, but over the entire world. And when he says to them, I am the Lord your God, he brought them into being, he chose them, he kind of made them and is guiding them. And then he's a redeemer, he brought them out of the land of Egypt. It's helpful for me to think about the reality that God isn't coming to his people with the Ten Commandments out of the blue as a stranger. It isn't, you think about somebody who you don't know, like one time when I was teaching young people at our church at Placerita, I just picked randomly one of the kids in the group, and I said, hey, I want you to come over to my house and weed my backyard for me. And there's a look of confusion across his face. Who are you to ask me to come weed your backyard? Because I'm a nobody, right? I'm somebody's dad, but I don't have the wherewithal to have him come weed the back of my part of my house. And so what God is doing here, he's reminding them that he's coming to them as somebody who's already amazingly invested in their existence. He brought them into being as a nation, delivered them from Egypt, brought them to this point. So he's asking them to live according to these lofty requirements as their the one who created them and the one who redeemed them. It's always helpful for us to keep that in mind, that when God asks of us what he does to live in a way that's radically different than the world around us, is countercultural, that doesn't match the worldview and the general impetus of the world around us, that can cause some pain, that's okay. He's done so much for me already, right? He's coming to me as my redeemer. All right, so first commandment, give exclusive allegiance to Yahweh. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out. And then verse 7, do not have other gods besides me. Now, literally in Hebrew, there will not be for you. There is no verb in Hebrew for possession or relationship, really. It's like there will not be for you other gods besides me. And this is how they show the idea of both possession, like it's there will be for you a book. You know, you have a book. There is for you a book. You have a book. Or there is not for you a wife. You don't have a wife. Right? This is how they say it in Hebrew. But the point is, they're talking about either possession when it talks about a book, or relationship when it's talking about a person, even God. So it's trying to scratch the itch of human divine relationships. And in Leviticus 26, 12 to 13, which has the core statement, the core value of the Mosaic or Israelite covenant, I'll be your God, you'll be my people. I will walk among you and be your God, and you will be my people. I'm Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt so that you would no longer be their slaves. I broke the bars of your yoke and enabled you to live in freedom. So he's just emphasizing that Leviticus passage, I will walk among you and be your God. You will be my people. And then he goes to what he had done in their behalf. So there's this relationship that exists. And so do not have a relationship with other gods besides me. I will have you for a people. You will have me for God. So other gods here, by the way, and there are scholars who say this that I don't believe in. Is Moses saying don't have, well, is God saying that Moses is relating to us? Is are God and Moses granting the legitimate existence of other gods in the world? Because he says, do not have other gods besides me. I would say no. I mean, there are various scholars in my commentary in Deuteronomy in the part where I said this is not henotheism, believing that God is the supreme God, but granting the existence of other gods, that Moses is saying, yeah, there are other gods out there, but just this God is the one you should have. And I made the point that I thought he's talking about in the marketplace of ideas, that they know of other gods that are referred to by people that are out there that they worship. He doesn't believe in them, and he's trying to emphasize to his people that there is just one God for you. Yahweh, the editor told me, had to change that, and I told him it's my commentary. So, and I gave him the evidence. Because I think he's using a statement here because of what God's people face, surrounded by a world, those polytheistic, all of those are not gods, small g, non-existent, empty windbags, that they non-existent, but are in the marketplace of ideas, nobody, none of those, except me. Moses is not granting the actual existence of other gods. And so in this literary context, the statement would be monotheistic. Only God exists. Just so you know, if somebody tried to grab that and say he believes other gods, I'm not convinced of that at all. Remember the immediate context. Chapter 4 declared Yahweh's incomparability. No other God had ever done or said what Yahweh had done or said. That reality occasions only one response, the recognition that he is the one and only true God. To put it another way, there are no other gods for Israel. He's trying to demonstrate that what he has done was unparalleled. No other gods for you besides me. Lots of ways they translate that besides me, but I'm not going to go through all of those possible options. The point here, other gods must not be given the same other gods that might not even, that don't even exist, that are empty windbags, that have never done anything, but can be worshipped, other gods must not be given the same standing as Yahweh, for he exists alone as Israel's God. God will not allow any kind of syncretism. Syncretism, what's that? It's God plus. Worship of God plus. And that's not acceptable. Because any gods that they're going to worship, God Baal, Molech, Chemosh, others, Tammuz, others that are referred to in Scripture are illusions. They're images they have made of them, and they have a worship system around them. Never done a thing. Never concrete. But yet, people are enamored by them so often. So don't let anything, not just an alleged God, anything, have first place in your life besides Yahweh, the one and only true God. And let me just emphasize something here. It will come up again here, but I want you to understand, I do believe that what the Bible, the Old Testament is, it presents God and God alone, a monotheism, one God instead of many. In the larger world of the Middle East, there's worship of many gods. But I think what the Ten Commandments are addressing aren't the doesn't involve the philosophical orthodoxy of just monotheism, one God. I think it's talking about the exclusive reality of one God for you. I'll say something in a moment to clarify that. So the command is not so much an apologetic for the sole existence of Yahweh, then, as it is a prohibition about them allowing in his same company at the same level as a theocratic rival. Summary of the big idea. The agenda of this verse is not to make a statement on the existence of other gods, even though it's true. The Bible presents God as the only God. It simply prohibits, because when it says other gods, he's not saying they're out there. It simply prohibits Israel from having any other gods in addition to Yahweh, all empty windbags, but still a corruption of their heart. In other words, it doesn't address the idea of the validity of polytheism in theory, but quite clearly denies the legitimacy of polytheism for Israel. Let me read this Wright's quote, and then I'll pause for a minute. Chris Wright says this in his commentary. The primary purpose of the primary commandment, first commandment, is to assert and protect the exclusive covenantal sovereignty of Yahweh as God over the Israelites and their exclusive covenant allegiance to him. In other words, the fundamental thrust of the verse is not Yahweh's sole deity, but Yahweh's sole sovereignty over Israel, sole claim on all that they are. On the basis of the historical fact just stated in verse 6, is the one who is their God and who delivered them from Egypt. I mean, in this world, other gods, they're non-gods. There are no real gods. They're all empty windbag gods. And Israel's told, there are really no other gods for you besides me. Even if you're going to worship something that doesn't exist, it's still a problem. It's a distraction. Now, in my world, I have a sweet wife, Martha Ann, right? I love her with all of my heart. Now, there are other women there are in the world around me. Now, so in this sense here, the point is the same, except there are actual other women that exist in the world. In that world, there are no other women for me because I have pursued a lifelong, committed relationship with Martha Ann. So it's a similar deal, except there are other people, women out there, and this is an exclusive requirement that I gladly embrace. It's not that here in Deuteronomy, there are no other gods that exist. All of them are empty windbags. And the language used here, I mean, they could have said, Mike, once you married Martha Ann, no other girls for you, which I'm totally good with, right? That's the whole the goal, one of the goals of my life, right? I've told Martha Ann I have sought to, and I am loving you with purity, and I want to do that until the day I die. I don't want to be a blemish in God's name. I don't want to violate the vows I've made to her. I want to honor God in that. All right, so, but in this case here with Moses, he wants them to know that there needs to be this total focus on God as the ultimate leader and Lord of their lives, their Savior. All right, so it's talking about practical loyalty, not philosophical orthodoxy. And so what does the Lord prohibit here? You must not break your exclusive relationship with me, is the point. First commandment. Second commandment. And this is where there are some differences of opinion. I would say the second commandment, allow Yahweh alone to define his image. Allow Yahweh alone to define his image. We're going to look at those verses. There's a prohibition against constructing images of Yahweh, verse 8. And this raises the question, do these verses belong to the first commandment, addressing the problem of idolatry, worshiping other gods? The first one dealt with the issue like in a big picture way, and the second one is saying, and don't make any images of those other empty windbag gods. Or is it really a second commandment? And there are those that would say verses 6 all the way to the end of 10 are one command. And I would suggest to you that the first one rules out worship of other gods and all that goes with it. Anything that would distract you from the worship of Yahweh, making any images of that empty windbag god, all of that is rejected. I would say then the second commandment is focusing on Yahweh. Allow Yahweh alone to define his image. So the Israelites, they say here on right below 5:8, a couple of paragraphs, the Israelites were not to make any image of Yahweh in the form of anything in creation, whether animate or inanimate things. So it says here, don't make an idol for yourself in the shape of anything in the heavens above or on the earth below or in the waters under the earth. So everything is accounted for in the creation of the universe, if you will, in the shape of anything in the heavens above, astronomical bodies, on the earth below the heaven, or the waters under the earth. So you're not supposed to make any image of God. No concrete physical image of God that would facilitate your worship. It prohibits worshiping what we've created as an image rather than the Creator himself, who has not taken on human form. Remember, Theophany, Deuteronomy 4, referred to at Exodus 19. You know, clouds, lightning, thunder, voice booming out. He didn't present himself in bodily form. And so he's saying, don't try to define me with the best image you could think of. So why? Why is this important as a second commandment that relates to no images of God? Well, God has not revealed himself to his chosen people in an objective or tangible form. Deuteronomy 4. Images of God could lead to idolatry. Craigie, another commentator, suggests that while maintaining the faith and worship of one Lord, the expression of that faith and worship might adapt itself to forms or imageries of the ancient Near Eastern religions. I mean, that's just... Do you know anybody, let's say, in Catholicism, where they have St. Christopher out in their front yard? Or, you know, other things, it just becomes then that's their guy. I mean, that's the one that they're paying attention to. That's the one they're revering. They're praying to that one to give them safety on the road. An image, and we're going to see this a little later, but I'll just mention it again here. What happens to the bronze serpent? You remember, you had the rebellion of God's people, a curse of poisonous snakes afflicted God's people. They were dying left and right, and God said to Moses, I want you to make a brass serpent and put it on a pole and put it up on the hill. And a person is bit by that bronze serpent. If they look up to that bronze serpent believing that that's going to help them, they're going to be cured of the poisonous bite. Well, this is what God had Moses do, right? What did Hezekiah have to face? A later king, hundreds of years later. They had taken their bronze serpent, they called him Nehushtan, and they're worshiping it in Israel. And he had to grind it into dust and put it in the river to go flow away. Because things that are images, concrete images, replace who God is. There are other examples I could give you of that. And then the other problem is why God says let him alone define the image of himself based on who he is and what he's done recorded in his word. An image confines the greatness and transcendence of God. Wright says this, Yahweh is the living God, and any carved statue is necessarily lifeless, something that can do nothing, is no image of the God who can do all things. Yahweh is the God who, though he cannot be seen, speaks through his word, even audibly, to certain prophetic individuals in Moses. Any attempt to turn God into a voiceless statue gags God. Yahweh is the incomparable God. It is futile to imagine anything in heaven, above and earth, beneath and the waters below, there could be an adequate representation. By making him in an image, we've degraded him to something comparable. It may be the best thing you could think of, but it doesn't satisfy the full dimensions of a great God. So, and then you might wonder, does this prohibit people or churches from having an image of a cross someplace, or you have Sunday school curriculum that may have a picture of Jesus, a human concoction, but a picture of Jesus, or a necklace with Jesus kind of on a cross? I'm not a big fan of that personally for me, but I would say that's not a problem. That's not what this is addressing, because Jesus took on human form. He died on a cross. So if that's a magic term, then that's a problem, right? If that's something that is distracting you from the worship of God, it's a problem. If it is a genuine impetus for your gratitude for the transforming power of the gospel through Christ, well, yeah, I understand. But the question, I would just say I wouldn't use this passage, even though quite often I don't like the way they have pictures of Jesus, and I don't have an alternative to suggest, but that isn't what this is addressing. Or angels, because there are two angels, cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant and other places. So it's addressing, fundamentally, defining who God is by a physical image when all of those things downsize God, take away his power and strength. All right, then prohibition against worshiping those images. Okay, that's totally, don't make them, and then, of course, don't worship them. The prohibition in the first part of verse 9. You must not bow down to them or worship them. Pretty clear. Don't bow down to them or worship them. Whether you prostrate yourself before them, don't worship them. Don't give them your allegiance, your awe, your reverence, your heart. And then what's the grounds for that prohibition? It says in verse 9 at the end, because I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And we talked about this a little bit before. Since Yahweh committed himself exclusively to them, I am your God, and you are my people. Throughout Israel's history, and even since then, God has always been perfectly faithful to his role as their God. Israel quite imperfectly carried out their role as his people. But he was jealous for their exclusive worship, trust, belief, and affection. So anybody worshiping anything or other than anyone other than God himself is violating that command. And that's why some people call it harlotry, immorality, theological immorality. I had a book when I first came to California at TMS, and we were having doctor's appointments and setting up all this stuff. I was going to write a book review, and a book by Ray Ortland called Whoredom. I was trying to redeem the time, and I'm at doctor's appointments and with my wife, and the kids are with the doctor or whatever, and I'm reading this book, and my wife said, hey, put that away. I mean, it just was like, what's my husband reading about whoredom for? Okay, I get the idea. I'll read that someplace else. But that's because there are various passages in the law and in the prophets that hammer God's people for their worship of other gods as harlotry, as immorality, theologically. And so it's a very serious thing. And so it provokes God's jealousy. I'm going to read here Deuteronomy 32, 16, and 21, describing Israel. That's what I was referring to, Tom, when you were asking about Deuteronomy 32. I talked about a jealousy deal. Describing Israel, they provoked his jealousy with foreign gods. They enraged him with detestable practices. They have provoked my jealousy with their so-called gods. They have enraged me with their worthless idols. Psalm 78, 58. They enraged me with their high places and provoked his jealousy with their carved images. Exodus 34, 12 to 16. Be careful not to make a treaty with the inhabitants of the land you're entering. Otherwise, they'll become a snare among you. Instead, you must tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, chop down their Asherah poles. You're never to bow down to another god, because Yahweh, being jealous in nature, is a jealous God. So what's the deal about God being jealous? We talked about it a little bit before. Jealousy is not a passion to get even or even revenge, to make things get your pound of flesh. It's something that prevents God from perfect enjoyment of a pure relationship with his chosen people. Yahweh's jealousy for Israel, sometimes in the prophets called his wife, which I think is a metaphor to describe something Israel would understand, requires that she offer her devotion to no other lover, just as a man will share his wife with no other. And it's not like the human jealousy that arises from selfishness, of course, whether it be time, toy, even a relationship where it's just a selfish issue. No, God's as unselfish in a way that it is pure, wanting an exclusive relationship. In a pluralistic world, then and now, this kind of exclusive claim, just like only one way for salvation, this kind of exclusive claim, God alone, grates on outsiders. In Israel's historical setting, all the nations that surrounded her worshiped many gods. Worship of one never precluded the worship of another god. In our day, people are offended by the claims that the God of the Bible is the one and only true God. Bible doesn't support religious pluralism as such. Right, Chris Wright says something really helpful here in his commentary. A God who is not jealous for the reciprocal commitment of God's people would be as contemptible as a husband who didn't care whether or not his wife was faithful to him, or a wife with her husband. Part of our problem with this profound covenantal reality is that we have come to regard religion, like everything else, as a matter of consumer choice, which we have virtually deified for its own sake. We resent monopolies. But the unique and incomparable, only living God makes necessary exclusive claims and has the right to a monopoly on our love. So the point here is, let God define himself and don't worship any other images, because that violates the exclusive commitment Yahweh expects from his followers. Not something minor, it's major. And it just, in our world, that kind of exclusivity is sadly and growingly, increasingly less common. All right, so then we've talked about the prohibition, the grounds for the prohibition, jealous God, 3I, the divine response to disobedience or obedience. What does God do about this? And this is where we can spend a lot of time, but I'm going to try to cover it as clearly as I can. So verse 9, you must not bow down to them or worship them, because I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And here comes the tough part. Punishing the children for the father's sin to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing faithful love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commands. Hey, what is that? Well, I asked some questions here in the notes. Are people going to be punished for the sins of others? Short answer, no. Okay. Does Moses here refer to cross-generational retribution? The idea that later generations will be held responsible for the sins that their ancestors committed. Some scholars have suggested that God would regard the descendants of a sinner as guilty for that person's sin, as far as the fourth generation after the sin committed. There's a a commentator who has a lot of good things, Jeff Tegay, in his commentary on Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 24, talks about this as an example of cross-generational retribution, where the later generation is held responsible for the former generation's sin. And there's something interesting that causes them to have a conniption with the Jews. We have all of our books of the Old Testament are regarded as canonical. They're normative. They're authoritative. They're given by God to his people. And there was a time when some of the Jews in the period of Judaism after the second century and beyond, they wanted to toss the book of Ezekiel because they say Ezekiel contradicted this commandment. Because in chapter 18, what Ezekiel does is the Jewish exiles in Babylon are whining and moaning about being the wrong person. We're getting punished, but it's our parents' fault. They did it. And they sell aside that, they ate the sour grapes and our teeth are set on edge. Yeah, they're the ones that deserve the punishment, not us. And Ezekiel says, guess what? The soul that sins, it will die. Individual responsibility. So some Jewish rabbis want to get rid of the book of Ezekiel because it contradicted the second commandment. It didn't contradict the second commandment. It contradicted their interpretation of the second commandment. So individual responsibility is always the case. I would say here, again, Deuteronomy 24:16, I have in the notes, fathers are not to be put to death for their children or children for their fathers. Each person will be put to death for their own sin. So each person is individually responsible for their sin, whether, and if it's not covered by Christ's redemptive sacrifice. So then what about the third and the fourth generations? Now, I would also tweak the word punishing. I would probably say bringing consequences on the children for the father's sin to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. It isn't direct punishment. And we all know people who have pursued a life of sin, whether it's alcoholism, drug abuse, all kinds of things. And there are ways that hammers some things about their own kids, right? Whether it be a pre kind of inclination for alcohol, or it could be genetic consequences with drug use during in the womb. Or there are consequences to sin that aren't direct punishment, but there could be ways that it impacts the next generation. So I would change the word punish to bring consequences of the father's sin. So the mention of the third and fourth generation, by the way, both times you have generation in your passages, it isn't in Hebrew. So it says punishing the children for the father's sin of the third and fourth of those who hate me and showing faithful love to a thousand of those who love me. It seems like in that case there's a missing word. This is a place where a translator puts in the word that makes the best sense in the context, and generation seems to be that word. Whatever it is, it'd be the same for both examples, but generation seems to be a reliable fill-in. So mention of third and fourth generations. Four generations mark the common span of human life. All right, so, I'm older than dirt. I'm 68, but our kids have gotten married late, and we have 10 grandkids, but we're not going to see great-grandkids. Our oldest grandson is 7, right? So it just, we didn't start late. We got married and had 8 kids, and they just started late. So the point is though, most people, like my wife's mom, when she died 12 years ago or so, we had a family reunion on the Sunday before she died. We didn't know she was going to die. There were like 120 descendants, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren. I mean, she was in her mid-80s, and her kids married younger. And so anyway, you had kids, children, mom, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and one or two greats. So there was 5. But most people only have, the max they see in life are 4 generations. And then they die, right? So I think third to fourth generation is as far as you could conceive. A person who lives by covenant treachery creates images of God that are corrupting, that chop him off at the knees, if you will, that take away his incomparability, and then worship those images. That kind of a life, being brought up in that kind of a life, could have consequences of children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren carrying on that covenant treachery, as far as you can imagine. And so, what about the concept of individual responsibility? Again, it's not responsibility like punishment. It just is consequences of being brought up in a sinful environment. I mean, my mom, her dad was an alcoholic. He had five wives and multiple sets of kids, was irresponsible, didn't want to take care of them, but didn't want to give them up for adoption. So my mom bounced around foster homes and orphanages. In God's mercy and grace, though, at a little older than primary age, she was in a home of a believing family, and she accepted Christ, and God redirected that ship. But I tell you, my mom's family are thugs and bums. I'm in that family name. And it's just a sad, it's like Benedict Arnold and Aaron Burr, no, John Edwards and Benedict Arnold, was it? They've done a study of their family tree, and the one is like good citizen, preachers, doctors, whatever, and this is the thugs, the bums, the criminals, the dirtbags. And so sin, raising up families in a sinful environment, has a tendency to have generational impact. And that's what he's saying is. And so as a family, then, as we, and when we think about, I'll tell you what we're doing as mom and dad, we're asking God to help us build for generations, right? We don't want to just get to 18 where the kids are 18, we're done, okay, you're on your own, buddy. I just get out of my life. I'm gonna play now. No, we want to be able to see our kids then pass on a vibrant faith to their kids, and if we're around long enough to see that continue, because that's a generational perspective of seeing God's work in somebody that makes a difference. Well, on the sinful side, the same thing is true. Is living a life of covenant treachery, of disobedience, of no allegiance to God, of no vibrant inside out relationship with Him can have long term, as far as we can imagine, impact. Chris Wright says this on page 7, I think it is, sin, and especially the sin of idolatry, reaps rewards in the living generations of those who practice it. Israel's extended families included three and often four generations, and the effects of one generation's failure in covenant loyalty would detrimentally affect the succeeding ones, who would grow up without teaching and with an idolatrous example and environment. And so just, they're surrounded by, this is how you live life, and they go ahead and make a mess in their lives too. And thus in the covenant community, no man was an island. His acts had repercussions for others, and the breach of this commandment could affect his posterity for more than one generation. So it just is, you know, some of you are older like me. Others of you are young. And don't take this lightly. Love your kids. Well, first of all, love each other as husband and wife with faithfulness and genuineness. And then as you do that, as you love your kids and you speak into their lives and you call them to account and you hold them to righteousness, you push them along. And it just, we want to be able to, not knowing when the Lord will return, to be able to pass on a vibrant faith in God's greatness and God's love in the gospel to impact the world we are, not knowing when He'll return. So that three and four, I think, is the kind of the, he's saying, this is, as far as you can imagine, this is going to wreck your life. This is going to cause generational covenant treachery. How about the next one? Covenant faithfulness for those who love Yahweh as long as 1,000 generations. So the punishing, I think, is bringing the consequences of this covenant treachery on the third and fourth generation. Verse 10 is easier, showing faithful love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commands. The covenant faithfulness, the word here is chesed. It's a Hebrew word that some of you have heard only. I don't say Hebrew words just for fun, but sometimes you've heard those before. It's talking about a faithfulness in the context of a relationship. God is perfectly faithful. And for us to have this word chesed, it's to be faithful in pursuing our great God in our relationship with him. So those who are characterized by covenant faithfulness, that in this case would be worshiping God exclusively from the heart, inside out loyalty. The point is, this is not a guarantee, this is not a prediction, but the point is that this often is way beyond comprehension. I mean, I'm here because of the intervention of God in my dad's life and my mom's life. My dad, an Italian Catholic, and my mom, just a dysfunctional family. And the Lord redirected our ship, right? Praise God. I'm so, so thankful. I always thought I had a boring testimony. I got saved at 5. And that was okay. And God saved me from a bunch of stuff. But I just, as I heard more about my parents, it was just so grateful for God changing that ship direction in my parents' lives that came into my life. But I would just say that the issue here is, as we think about wanting to build for generations, I don't want to just have me survive and Martha and I survive our kids getting to 18. I want to see our grandkids love the Lord and do what God wants. And then if we're alive, to our grandkids to be lights in a dark world and a blessing in a local church and all of that. And the issue he's saying that if an Israelite family was characterized by covenant faithfulness, embracing wholeheartedly this committed relationship with Yahweh that shows up in worshiping him according to his definition, he blesses that with, it's like eternity, salvation. He shows covenant love, steadfast love toward those in the context of a covenant relationship. Showing faithful love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commands. It's like beyond comprehension, the 1,000 generations. God is, through Moses, trying to say, what I want for you is always the best. Always the best. Always has the greatest honor for my glory. It's something you should want to pursue. So, anyway, so why the contrast between the third and fourth generation, third and fourth, and then 1,000 generations? God's punishment lasts for a few generations, but his grace endures for all generations. God speaks of punishment in terms of living memory and of covenant love in terms of unimaginable long-distance future. And so what I want is, as humanly speaking, we all know I have an unsaved brother who heard the same message I did and grew up in the same home I did, who doesn't embrace salvation by faith. And, we also know that we have no control here, right? We can invest, we can love, we can teach. We aren't guaranteed. And so if you're here with a prodigal son and daughter, you're not the loser of the universe, right? I'm not saying that. I mean, I have a son, I'm not exactly sure where he's at. He professes Christ, but I don't see the vibrancy I want to see in him. So I understand that. But that doesn't change what I want to pursue, right? Just to summarize here, again, Chris Wright does a great job. At the second half of his commentary, I'm a little less excited, and you'll see tomorrow when we talk about Mosaic Law and the Christ follower, he brings over some of the Mosaic Law more than I would. He can write things really well. Like the first 11 chapters of Deuteronomy, I'm especially happy. He writes this, to summarize the first two commandments. Together, the first and second commandment are truly the most fundamental of all, for everything that follows hangs on them. Their importance is reflected in the fact that Deuteronomy chapters 4 and 6, like an envelope, around the Decalogue in chapter 5 are really extended meditations on the challenge of the prologue and the first two commandments. Their prominence also reflects the fact that biblically idolatry is a fundamental human sin. The essence of our fallenness is that we choose to reject the authority of our Creator God and to substitute it, and to substitute in God's place an allegiance to other authorities, to other presumed ultimates, to other systems and values of our own creation. Apostasy and idolatry are the classic root sins of Israel in the Old Testament because they are the essential marks of the human condition. Jeremiah captured their poignancy and absurdity in his memorable imagery in chapter 2, verse 13. My people have committed two sins. Now, if you don't know this in a dry world, we have it in California some, but in Israel you have just two or three year-round rivers. And then your next best source would be springs with good flowing water from an aquifer. You could drill down to or at the bottom of a hill. Quite often they poke through the ground and you could harvest that water. You have rain, of course, but that leads to this, the third one, that is the least fun one, and that's a cistern. We find a rocky area, you carve out a big circular area, they plaster the wall of the cistern, and then you carve channels in the ground so in rainy season that water will be directed to fill up the cistern. Early on in the dry season, it's great, good water. But over the dry season, which is long, like in Southern California, you know, birds die and fall in, or other critters fall in and drown, and you know, just dirt, and it gets more and more yucky. And so this is what he's saying. You know, if you think about all the water sources available to you, my people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water. I mean, it's amazing, right? Spring of living water. And they've dug their own cisterns. Goofballs, fools, why in the world? But they're broken cisterns that cannot hold water. And that's what they've turned to instead of me, the Lord says. That's the folly of sin and rebellion, by the way. People who do this are dust and ashes people. Broken cistern people. Okay, third commandment, 5:11. Do not misuse the name of the Lord your God, because the Lord will not leave anyone unpunished who misuses his name. So I have third commandment. Yahweh has the right to proper representation. Literally, the Hebrew reads, you should not lift up, bear, carry the name of Yahweh your God emptily, in a worthless fashion. And we have to realize that in the Old Testament, name is often regarded as an extension of, or even the substitute for, the whole person. When it says, may the name of the Lord be prominent in all the world, it isn't like billboards you have to pay for to put up. It just is, his whole character is made prominent through his people. So name, whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. It's more they're embracing by repentance and faith the salvation that is central to who Jesus is and what he provides. So what's the significance or meaning of this expression? Lots of options have been suggested. I think growing up, the improper use of Yahweh's name in swear context was where I focused on, and all of that. And I think this would be part of course, misusing his name. Do I want Mike to be the name everybody uses when they're really frustrated or angry or in some bad context? No, I wouldn't want that. But I'm at another spot. I'm at number 6. To bear the name of Yahweh, according to Dan Block, the idiom derives from the ancient practice of branding slaves with the name of their owner. Block goes on, to bear the name of Yahweh means to claim him as one's owner and to accept the role of representing him. At issue is Israel's status and the function of their function as a people of Yahweh. They must not claim Yahweh as their covenant Lord and then live as if they belong to Baal. To claim to be the people of Yahweh and live like the people of Baal is misusing the name of Yahweh. Carmen Imes, another scholar who wrote her dissertation on this, writes this. Israel must see itself as belonging to him, representing him to the world. To bear his name in vain would be to enter in this covenant relationship with him, but live no differently than the surrounding pagans. Israel's fate in the succeeding narratives always comes down to breaking these two commands, either failing to worship Yahweh alone or failing to represent him well. And I think it ties into the whole issue of the importance of representing Yahweh as a core value from Genesis 1 all the way to the New Testament. And we bear his name, we're Christ followers, or Old Testament was God's people identified with Yahweh, and all too often they misrepresented him by choosing to worship other gods and living lives of wickedness. And we'll come back. I'm trying to get to where I can leave you some time to ask pastor questions. You're welcome. I'm glad to help. All right, then the last one, the Sabbath, Shabbat, verses 12 to 15. Be careful to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy as the Lord your God has commanded you. You are to labor 6 days and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. You must not do any work, you, your son or daughter, your male or female slave, your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock, or the foreigner who lives within your gates, so that your male and female slaves may rest as you do. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. That is why the Lord your God has commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. So this is one of those two commandments that's expressed positively. The other one is honor your parents. And the basic statement of the command in 12 to 14, Sabbath, Shabbat, is the word, the Hebrew verb means to cease activity or rest. So it's a day of ceasing or resting. To keep it holy, I think, is not the idea of moral purity, but set apart for a unique purpose. I mean, how could a day be holy? It isn't intrinsic moral purity. It's by being consecrated, set apart, distinct. The people responsible to obey the command, everybody in Israel of all social classes. If you compare the text of Exodus, the Ten Commandments in Exodus, in this set of Ten Commandments, Moses added the slaves that weren't in the, and it doesn't mean the other ones weren't deficient. I think there are some places in the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy, there's a slight tweak where Moses, as the lawgiver and as the one that God is guiding, picked up on some way the Israelis were misusing these commands, and they had loopholes, and he shut those loopholes. But it would be everybody was supposed to cease activity. The theological rationale for the command, verse 15, and that's redemption from Israel. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. And if you read the book of Exodus, Exodus 20, the rationale there is different. It's the creative week. 6 days he worked, seven he rested. And I think these are not competitive rationales. The issue is, I think the Exodus rationale helped clarify the sixth and the seventh day as something God modeled. It wasn't that God ran out of gas. He was tired out. He needed to take a nap or take a day off, and so he had a day of rest. It was to model something that was important. And so the rationale is given to help people understand 6 days, and then a seventh day was a Shabbat, was a Sabbath. And Sabbath isn't mentioned from Exodus 20 back until Genesis 1. So the Exodus account of the Ten Commandments focuses on God's cessation of creative activity as the theological backdrop for this command. Deuteronomy looks to the redemption of Israel from bondage as slaves for this command's theological foundation. According to Deuteronomy, Israel's keeping of the Sabbath constituted a celebration of God's mighty deliverance of them from their oppressive bondage in Egypt. So to rest, abstain from labor for a day, served as a reminder of God's deliverance of them from perpetual slavery. And he does say in the end of verse 14, remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. God brought you out. So the point here would be is that I'm going to suggest that the shift of rationale from Exodus to Deuteronomy isn't, again, a correction, but it provides a nearer point of emphasis that they knew what life was like and God's redemption of them from that horrific circumstance that should have motivated their celebrating who he is and what he does. All right, so on the one hand, this is the way you would celebrate the Sabbath sounds like when it says cessation of activity, rest, even in the Old Testament and even in rabbinic situations to some degree, it can be done in various ways. It doesn't mean that you can't, like in a hotel in Israel. On Shabbat, you have a Sabbath elevator and you have a non-Sabbath elevator. The Sabbath elevator, you don't have to push any buttons. The door opens, you walk on, and it stops at every floor. And you get off on your floor. So there's no work having to push a button. But of course, then you got your room, what are you gonna do? Call your slave, your Gentile slave to let you in. You gotta take out the key and put it in the deal to get in the door, right? So it's kind of weird. But so then they're trying to, as best they can, cease activity. They normally, the more wealthy ones will go to a hotel and have a restaurant meal so they don't have to cook, because it's Sabbath, right? So I would think that there was probably something different about that day. It wasn't the average work day. 6 days they would work the fields or take care of their animals or whatever, and Sabbath was supposed to be make sure Friday night you put on enough food for 2 days or have enough water for a couple of days and prepare your food and your meals so you don't have to cook on Sunday, maybe like that. We don't know exactly how they practiced it. Sorry, I gotta not get away from the mic. But I think the more prominent thing is that you're gonna set it apart, you're gonna consecrate it, and you're gonna celebrate a God who created you and the universe in 6 days, rested on the seventh, or he redeemed you from Egypt, a place of slavery. So it's going to involve a celebration of who God is and what he's done. Now I say here on the next section is a key interpretive question. We'll talk more about this tomorrow probably. How should the Mosaic Sabbath compound our life and conduct, our life conduct? Well, and I say we'll talk more about this tomorrow. But I will teach that God does not expect that we should obey the Mosaic law as law. I don't call tomorrow, Sunday, a Sabbath. In the New Testament, the Christians met in the first day of the week. So I wouldn't call it a Christian Sabbath. It's the worship model given to us by the New Testament, first day of the week. But when you think about this as a Ten Commandment, what do we do? Well, we aren't called to take the Ten Commandments as law. And the Sabbath is the one commandment that doesn't seem to be re-enunciated in the New Testament with any kind of specificity. So on the one hand, one option is doesn't come across at all. Okay, that's one option. What's the problem with that? Well, was Jesus under the law when he created the universe? Well, no, it was pre-law, right? So what he did, created 6 days, rested the seventh day, pre-law would seem to be, is there a principle there for us to follow? And I'm just, gonna kind of talk through this a little bit, and if you disagree with me, then ask Joe. No, we can talk about it. So, I would say, I think there is a Sabbath principle to think about. In Genesis 1, I think having your notes, the Lord refers to the Sabbath idea when he rested on the seventh day. What's the point of this rest? It provides a model, the model for the Mosaic law Sabbath commanded in Exodus 20. What does the Sabbath principle look like? Well, first of all, I'd say, fundamentally and most importantly, God modeled for us a day that was unlike all the other days. And so Sunday wouldn't be the day, the Saturday, I mean, if you have a Sabbath, but I'm talking about a Sabbath principle where I'm not going to try to fill it as much as I can with whatever kind of activity that I have no time for God. So that means that I would happily have my day include fellowship with God's people, hearing the teaching of the Word, trying to connect with brothers and sisters from Christ in various settings as a common part of the day. I don't have a problem with you having company, you forgot you didn't have, you don't have some beans, string beans to have with your dinner, and you have to stop by and get a can or two or frozen stuff on the way home. But I'm not trying to fill my day with shopping either. It isn't the National Football League contest day where I can watch as many games as humanly possible or whatever. I mean, it doesn't mean you can't do anything fun. You can't go on a walk on a path with your family or whatever. I think it's a conscience question how you do it, but I think it means that we have to have a day that's not like every other day that includes the celebration of who God is and what he's done in a way that exhorts our hearts and helps us value that. And I would also say with that Sabbath principle, we do it on Sunday, and that would be the model, because it was the first day of the week that the church worshiped and gave their funds and all of that in the New Testament. What if you lived in a Muslim world where Friday was the day off and Sunday was a work day? And if you had church on Sunday, all the guys couldn't come unless it was late Sunday night. How about Israel, where Shabbat is a day off? They work 6 days a week or 5 3/4 days a week. And if you want to have it on Sunday, that's their first day back a week and everybody's supposed to be there. So the Messianic assemblies worship on Shabbat because that's when everybody has the day off. And so I think we have to be a bit flexible. I had a pastor early on in California who's Irish, Phil DeCourcy, who was more Sabbatarian. So if we had a Monday where the schools were off on Monday and we had a youth event on Sunday night or go to somebody's swimming pool, his girls couldn't come because it was Sabbath. It was his conscience. He didn't ask the rest of us to do that, but that's what he did. And I believe in a family conscience. I believe that Mom and Dad, Martha Ann and me, our hands on the rudder of the ship Grisanti, and we're going to try to live out our conscience, and there are going to be ways that I may not like be Deacon or Elder Joe or Sam, but it isn't, we're more spiritual. We're trying to live out our conscience. So I think there is some variety in how we would celebrate this, but it isn't law, and it isn't exactly what the fourth commandment was in the Mosaic law, in a primary agricultural environment, and all of that. And it's not re-enunciated in any kind of clear way in the New Testament, so I'd say I have to have a day that isn't like the other days, where I can worship, learn, fellowship, hear the word, exhort one another to love and good works. Even then you have to ask, you know, play in the backyard, go for a walk. I'm okay with all of that if it doesn't crowd out time with God's people in church, hearing the word taught, looking for times of fellowship that isn't like a normal work day. All right. I was trying to talk, so I didn't have any time for questions, but no, I wasn't. So any questions for any of this? Yes. Yep.
You said Yahweh's jealousy for his wife, Israel.
So what I said in that sentence was in the prophets.
Well, that's not my question.
Oh, okay.
My question is, we are the bride of Christ.
Yeah.
How does that connect?
Yeah, I would say in the New Testament, the reference to the church as the bride of Christ is maybe a tighter theological metaphor, where he's using that bride of Christ as part of the marriage supper of the Lamb and other things. I think in the Old Testament it's more of a loose metaphor to show this committed relationship between Yahweh and his people. And then you have in Jeremiah, he uses divorce language, which I think is metaphorical, not actual. It isn't that God's relationship with Israel was wiped out and taken away. It uses a term that is drastic, showing disruption in a relationship to bring the weight. So I think it's less tightly theological than in the New Testament. I think it's a metaphor.
Yeah, I have a amillennial son, so he would probably describe that as a divorce.
Yeah. Yeah, but I still would say in the prophets, I understand why he would do that. But we do have other places where the Lord, and even the prophets after Jeremiah, use the intimate terms to describe God's relationship with his people, that he hasn't written them off, that he has a plan for them. And you have Amos 9 about the restored hut of David, you know. And so, yeah, I think it's a looser metaphor in the Old Testament. And the New Testament is tied in to other things, marriage supper of the Lamb, and even, you know, the way husbands and wives, husbands love their wives, and some other things that it's a metaphor that's used in a tighter theological way in the New Testament and looser, more broadly.
I just never heard anyone refer to Israel as a wife.
Yeah, that's the prophets do that. Yeah. Okay, anybody else? I wonder which one we're thinking about. I don't think so. I mean, Jesus took on human form, right? My concern isn't the existence of a movie that has an actor playing Jesus, who we all know isn't Jesus. He's a human being who is not eternal and all of that. This is not a brag or meant to be a slam. I've not watched The Chosen, right? And I've read of people who have, and sing its praises, and others who spit in the ground after you say the word. And I'd say, with art, creative art, especially presenting biblical truth, is just really a minefield, right? So VeggieTales. I didn't grow up with the VeggieTales, but I've had kids, you know, in ministries. And that is their definition of the Jonah story, the David and Goliath story, right? And it's like, you gotta be kidding me. Come on, grow up. And that just is how they've learned it. And I think there are tools. I mean, we have tapes we've listened to. Patch the Pirate. I don't know if you've ever heard of Patch the Pirate. But anyway, there's some kids' songs that have characters and whatever that are helpful to help them grasp concepts. Or Left Behind. Okay, we read and listened to that series. It was a Drive to Montana deal, and it wasn't my theology textbook. It wasn't like I knew that's exactly how it was going to happen. I blah, 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 but it was a way, and the gospel was presented. And so I don't want to tell the kids, you know, that. But that's where we have to then take a chill pill with. The part I don't know about The Chosen and all that I've read about Little Mormon stuff sneaking in. I heard they've cut that part of that studio out of the equation at this point. I would say having a guy who plays the role of Jesus isn't the problem. There are other movies that have done that. As long as it's very clear this is a media thing that isn't replacing Jesus. But that's me. Joe, you're the pastor. I don't know if you have, I don't want to put you in a bad spot with The Chosen.
I've never seen it either.
Oh, okay.
I can spare
it. Yeah. So, I mean, I have friends who, boy, they're, you know, the arrows they shoot and whatever, obviously they don't like it at all. I've never watched it, but I don't think the principle of having a movie that has a human being playing Jesus is the issue. It's whether truth is presented. And then the other problem is, of course, and this is with other movies as well on biblical issues or some video presentation, is there's artistic license where you have to have narratives that aren't in the Bible to fill in. Otherwise, you're kind of like, okay, what happened? I mean, you jumped from here and you went nothing, and then you jumped in here and it's like, well, what happened? I mean, you just have to realize that there's going to be things that aren't biblical, but aren't non-biblical. Yeah, anyway, what do I know?
You know, you quoted this interesting quote from the C. Wright.
Yep. Yeah.
In this
sense. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the sense of apostasy or theological departure, theological compromise, theological corruption, even denial, that's happening. But idolatry isn't just an image. We have idols in our life. Anything that replaces God as a primary source of our purpose and direction has replaced God, and it's an idol that's functioning. And so we have other things that take God's place. So idolatry, I think, is pretty common in the sense of that the function of idolatry being a replacement of God that shows up in all kinds of hobbies and dispositions and beliefs and other things. Joe, you're heading someplace there.
Oh. I was thinking Matthew 6:24, between
God and mammon, God and money, yeah.
It's likened to
an
idol.
Yep.
And I think Jesus particularly used a word that could be understood as an idol.
Yes, yes. And you can't do both.
It seems to me like in this culture, it's not that we're worshiping idols. It seems like our culture is focused on worshiping ourselves.
Well, I still would say, when you say worship, worship is so broadly used. I mean, like as we were saying last night, I think it's wrong to equate worship with just music. Worship is obedience. Worshipful life is an obedient life. I do think it's heart captivating. So if we're worshiping the Lord, we're pursuing Him. He's the one who's captivated our hearts and is defining who we are and how we should live. And there are other things that captivate our hearts. In hobbies, Facebook, sports, whatever. And so I do think that it's a replacement, is really replacing the role of God in our lives that should be dominant, should be most fundamentally important. And so I mean, I do think it's a bigger problem. I think it is a fundamentally important and sad problem where we have God replacements that are captivating our hearts and are really at the center of what we value. But anyway, the point is, there may be other primary, worst, or most dominant sins that are out there, and maybe one should be adjusted, but I do think those are both big problems.
I do think we need to be aware, though, that myths of like the Norse gods or whatever are actually making a comeback. I know a guy personally that believes Thor is God. He truly believes that.
Yeah.
So I mean, we've got to be careful on saying, well, we're in America, we're educated, and we don't bow down to wooden stone idols. We're going back to that.
Well, yeah, and I would say, being in a multicultural culture, Asian folks who have ancestor worship and they come here and they have their mantle with, I mean, there are idolatrous, fundamentally idolatrous Muslims have, well, they would call it a idol, but replacements of God, right. I mean, I do think you're right. It isn't like we're free from that. I do think that there's a lot of people in America who have something different than that. And all of those things are problematic because they're replacing or standing in the way of grasping a God who deserves their allegiance.
Growing up, I always heard
yep.
the American idol is money, fame, and women, pleasure.
Yep.
Which, it's true, those are, but these wooden stone idols are, like you said, because of the diversity, the melting pot of the world is America. And because America has gone away from following Judeo-Christian teaching, the rise of
Quote,
the old gods or False gods is more prominent than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, but what I think the comparison here would be, and I agree that's a reality, right, and not doubting that at all, the comparison what Wright is saying from Israel, God's people, to evangelicalism, the church, is a worldly place. I mean, look across the world and across America, and the idea of really this dedicated allegiance to the Lord, wanting to go where the Bible would take God's word being our authority for conclusions about values. Is Jesus God? Is gay marriage right? Or whatever. And you have born again evangelical believers not. I mean, it just seems like there's theological drift. And there is, in the evangelical church, if you will, a lot of folks having God replacements as ultimates in their life. But I would agree, in the larger world, for sure, they abound.